Every piece of this is man's bullshit. They call this war a cloud over the land, but they made the weather, and then they stand in the rain and say, shit, it's raining!
Yeah, if you want to know what that bullshit war was all about, that civil war, then just watch that film Cold Mountain, and you'll see how the capitalist North and the capitalist agrarian South had their little fun and games to the tune of hundreds of thousands of white people dying. And still people today eulogize the wonderful war, the wonderful war, the wonderful civil war. Our great southern heroes, our great northern heroes. Horse shit. And this is Terrible Tommy, and it's Moon's Day. And that's right, August the 10th, after our good buddy Augustus Caesar. How about it? He knew how to handle things. At least for a while. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And that's where you send your donations for the radio show. And it's time. It's time, boys and girls. And a lot of you are getting them in here, but we need some more. Don't get too far behind. Do I sound like one of those guys? What was that guy? I forget that guy turned out to be an FBI informant. Send me money. I need money. Lots of money. If you don't send me money, oh, I had this piece of equipment break down. It's going to cost me $1,000. I got to have a special technician in to take care of it and all that. And I need the money now. Come on, boys and girls. No, you're not going to get that bullshit from Tommy. As long as we got enough to pay the light bill and pay the website and a few pieces of cheap used equipment, and a bare bunker, we're going to be transmitting. So there's not too much of a way they can put us out of business, is there? Yeah, that's right. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Right. And we don't have chat rooms either. We don't want to listen to all that bullshit and all these people that go on the chat rooms and go on and on and on. They have the only answer, and you don't have any answers, and you're screwed up, and you're probably a Jew, and you're probably an informant, and this guy is wonderful, and I worship him, and Hitler never made any mistakes. He was a wonderful guy. Do you want to play around in those chat rooms like that all day? Boy, if you do, you're weird. You are weird, because some of the dumbest people in the world are on these chat boards, and the FBI and ATF and ADL and the Mossad, everybody, they all love those chat boards. They love those chat boards. All these guys out there say, well, I got to socialize. I got to go to these get-togethers. I got to go hear Dr. Duke give a speech. I got to spend $1,000 to get there. I got to go to this stuff because I need friends and associates, because I can't get along without friends and associates. Not like that damn Metzger, lone wolf. He don't need nobody except you independent lone wolf guys. You know the score. We don't need to sit around in a bar and drink all night. We don't need to sit out on a porch and socialize all night. We know the program. You can know people, have associates around. Like, I know people around town that I'm friendly to, and they're friendly to me, but that's as far as it goes. I don't try to recruit them to anything. And the way I do recruit is simply by ideas. I bring up things and I remind them of what the fuck is going on in the news and stuff like that. The best way to recruit is to neutralize the enemy. And Washington and Wall Street and the military-industrial complex is the enemy. They're the main enemy, not some raghead over in North Africa. No, in fact, I don't think that badly of ISIS myself. I mean, we've been setting them up for years. I mean, we set them up. We supplied them with all their equipment. Brand new equipment. Used once, you know. And they're pissed off. They're sick and tired of the United States of corporate America screwing around in their countries. Plus, they're a lot of them religious fanatics, that makes it worse. But sometimes it makes it better. I mean, if a guy is willing to charge a tank with a knife in his teeth, well, I can't talk him down, but that's pretty wild. So they can all talk about ISIS all they want. And, oh, ISIS is coming, ISIS is coming. Yeah, they got plenty of work to do over there. That whole thing is such a clusterfuck in the Middle East. It just drive you crazy to think about it. So don't think about it. Think of that gal, that blonde gal who gave Mr. Trump trouble. Just think of her boobs. That'll make you feel better. And read what she said on Howard Stern a few years ago. You know, Trump's exactly right about these tramps like this. You know, they screw everybody in the CNN higher staff, the whole board. Come on in. I'll have sex with you on the table in the boardroom. But just let me do the news. Let me do the news the way the Jews want the news. Okay, Metzger, quit. You're running off at the mouth again. You're doing that crazy stuff.
Well, I don't know about that. Well, come on, man. Get to the news, man. I like to talk about what's-her-name's titties. Makes me feel like a good American.
Yeah. Like Mr. Donald Trump, whose buddies are mostly Jews. Jews and his family, Jews and all his business dealings. He's going to save us. Oh, yeah, he's going to save us. And none of them going to save us if we don't save ourselves. That's the only way out. There's no other way out. So if you can't handle that, well, get out of the kitchen. But it doesn't take hardly anything to get the right wing to follow you. You say two or three, maybe, sort of, racial but not racial things, they'll follow you anywhere. Oh, he's the most wonderful guy that ever lived. Well, how did that son of a bitch get his billions? You mean he didn't screw anybody to get that money? You mean Mr. Trump didn't screw anybody, any white working people, or get them sell companies and they lost all their jobs and stuff like that? No, he's a good American. He's a good American. He wouldn't do that. That's why we're going to support him. All us guys down south here especially, we're going to support him, man. We need a man like Trump. I'd like to see old Mr. Trump in the privacy of his own apartment or house when nobody's listening and he's sitting there maybe with his girlfriend or something laughing about all this crap. This is funny, man. This is the funniest thing I've ever done. I'm having more fun than a barrel of monkeys. That's what he's doing. Give me another cocktail, baby, and put on that bikini. Well, boys and girls, I got two vehicles for sale right now and trying to get another one fixed up. And I don't know, but I came up with the best idea today. I got a pickup truck and a van, so I'm going to sell them both for one money. I got them out on the highway, and I've already got three or four people lined up out there. That's the best thing to do. Get one that's pretty real cheap, that's got problems, put it beside one that's better, sell them together. Yeah, both at once. I think I got them sold already. And I got my buddy putting me together in a 1999 Caddy Eldorado coupe. I'm finally going to get in style. So when I go to the David Duke exposés, I'll be looking like I am something, okay? Okay, let's quit this nonsense. Let's get to our show about our book about the Jews. When the Jews came to America. I hope you're enjoying it. If I can't find any of those little books, I think I'm going to reprint it. Or we're going to do it in PDF. I don't think we've got it up there. But this is really a great book. And it was written way back there around when Jack London was running around. Maybe Jack London did write it. I don't know. Here we go. The Jew Comes to America. This is chapter 6. And this is called The Jew in Politics. Oh my goodness. I thought he had more power out of politics but controlling politicians. Let's see what it says. If an Aryan and an Israelite come before you to decide any difference whatsoever, see that the Israelite wins the case. If you cannot openly do so, have the Israelite win the case in any way. if necessary, through craft and deceit. That is from the Talmud, so don't tell me that is not Jewish, and don't tell me that's some Aryan bastard putting it out and lying about the Jews, because it's right in their Talmud what they say. And you know, it's amazing. They tell you exactly what they're going to do to you. I mean, it seems like everybody that does things to people tells them first. Even Adolf Hitler said he was going to do, and he did it. In American politics, and especially in the politics of New York City, the so-called American Jew has come of late years to cut a very prominent figure. The state legislature, the New York judiciary, and the city and county offices are well studded with Jews, most of them of variety. Many of these are Hebraic office holders, have become what is known as baptized Jews. That is, they've alleged to have adopted the Christian religion and to have been baptized in the Christian faith. You know, it never says Christian fact. It's always Christian faith. By skillfully twisting and changing and anglicizing their names, they're often not known as Hebrews or Kikes among the general public. This, for instance, is the case with a well-known ex-commissioner of charities and corrections, whose first name is usually written plain Jake. And it is also the case with an equally well-known New York theatrical manager whose first name is identical with that of the late ruler of Abyssinia, and whose last name suggests something verdant and mossy, which, by the way, the aforesaid manager by no means is. But however much the Jew may conceal his true identity, however much he may anglicize his name, however much he may be drenched in the baptismal font, rely upon it, the Jew nature has remained unchanged. The detestation of and the desire to overreach the goyim, which means cattle, of course, to the Jews, that's us, which simmers in the Semitic blood, will not have grown one whit the less pronounced and ardent. In a word, he remains a Jew for that. Now, remember when we had the things that went with Torquemada over there in Spain, and all these Jews either faked back baptism into the Christian religion or just flat out lied, and they got heavily into the church, and they stayed in the church. So they didn't change, they just put on a different coat. The Jew vote has come to be recognized as a very important factor in practical politics. It is a vote which is especially telling, weighty, and formidable. Now understand, this is long before the invasion of the real Kikes at the end of World War II. This is way before that. It is a vote which is especially telling, weighty, and formidable from the fact that it is invariably cast solid, that is, it is voted in its full strength for any candidate of Jew blood or who represents Jew interests. No motives of partnership can divert the vote of the Jew voter from the Jew candidate. His vote is cast for the candidates of his race. Well, it's interesting to me that there are getting to be so many Jews in finance and so many Jews in religion and so many Jews in politics today that now they're starting to, in some cases, fight each other. Have you noticed that? You got right-wing Jews and left-wing Jews now. His vote is cast for candidates of his race regardless of what party he may belong to and what ticket he may be on. The Jewish vote is the most clannish in existence. That's why Aryans go sucking after him so much to get their vote. Oh, I got to have the Jew vote, and if I say anything against the Jews, I'm screwed. Tammany Hall fully recognizes this fact, and that is the reason why in the past few years no Tammany ticket has been put forward without having the names of two or more Jew candidates on it. Was this done because of the prominence and abilities of these candidates? and the ardent affection entertained by Tammany Hall for the Jew? Not much. It was done to catch this solid Jew vote, to strengthen thereby the general ticket. And, of course, you know, they have all these poor Jews huddled in the ghetto places in New York City. And, to be perfectly honest about it, they were living at about the same level as the other poor peasants. But these leader Jews had tremendous power over them. That's the thing to remember. And the working class Jew, no matter how much he wants out of the program, does not have the strength to break free, just like the Christians. One of the features of strength in the Jew vote is that, strange as it may seem at first blush, it is never bought or sold. Why? Because, as every practical politician well knows, the Jew voter would simply pocket the proffered bribe, and then, as he gleefully fingered the purchased money in his pocket, would cast his ballot for the candidates of his own race or religion. No, the practical politician never attempts to buy up the Jew vote. He knows a little too much for that. The people of this country had a striking example not long ago of the light in which Semitic blood is regarded at foreign courts, when the United States attempted to accredit an ambassador with a Jewish wife and Jewish leanings, first to Italy and later to Austria. Both of these countries energetically demanded the withdrawal of the obnoxious minister proposed. You notice how they send a lot of women and Jews into the Arab countries as ambassadors and so forth. It's an insult to these people. It's absolute insult. No wonder they hate our guts. Yet this rebuff seems to have had but little effect in awakening thought among Americans or Aryans. For as before stated, the Jew nose protrudes high and strong from all branches of our official life. Our minister at the most important court in Eastern Europe is a Jew, who, it is widely rumored, obtained his high office by virtue of large pecuniary advances made to prominent political personages. The only Jew who has ever governor of the proud little state of South Carolina turned out an arrant knave, and has in recent years been more than once behind prison bars. His Jew physiognomy today adorns the rogues' gallery in Inspector Burns' office. He looks very much in place. There are several Jews in Congress, and the New York State Legislature is thick with them. Most of them sprang from the humblest origin, and many of them, to put it mildly, of the very shadiest of shady antecedents. There's one Jew in New York today who is conspicuous by his arrogant manners and haughty bearing, who has successfully held the office of a judge of a district court, state senator, and dock commissioner. He is now a school trustee. He's not been out of the public office of any kind in the last 14 years. Once they get in there, they stay in there forever. He is a baptized Jew. That is, he claims he is a Christian. Don't believe him. Well, baptized Jew, so what? Christianity is just a watered-down version of Judaism anyhow. So he just goes from strict Judaism. Well, he may go from conservative Judaism, Reform Judaism, then to Christianity, modern-day Judaism. The present comptroller of the city of New York is a Hebrew Jew. They say Hebrew in here. You know, forget the Hebrews. They're just kikes. As for the bench of New York City, it is so full of Jews that it would be difficult to throw a stone among the judiciary without hitting a descendant of Jews, of the Jews. One of them, a squat, hook-nosed, suspicious-eyed person, was until recently on the bench of the city court. He's been succeeded by another Jew, a man notorious for his abandoned amours, and insatiable lechery. Let me tell you about lechery. We had a Jew in San Diego, must have been 20, 25 years ago now. I forget what his name was. It was a typical Jewish name. and he was discovered to be frequenting the prostitutes in San Diego. And his favorite habit among the prostitutes is to get one to get over him and shit on his chest. Now, you're going to say, oh, now that's going too far, Metzger. This is absolute truth. Golden showers and golden shit. Now, what happened? He was condemned a lot around town, but they never kicked him out of his judgeship. As far as I know, he retired, or maybe he's still on the bench. That just shows you how absolutely obscene these people are and how they get away with it and how Arians let them get away with it. Another Jew who in early life peddled fish and fruit graces for 14 years term of office the bench of Superior Court. And then you wonder why white guys get hammered. Another who first saw the light of day in a noisome tenement house in First Avenue presides over one of the most important judicial districts in the city. One of his most salient characteristics is his vanity, which renders him a veritable terror to reporters, whom he runs after, begging them to make mention of every little petty case of which he's connected, his object being to bring his name before the public. Now, isn't that just like Jews? They go crazy. They follow these reporters like mad. And, of course, they lie like hell, and usually many times the reporter's a Jew or a Jew lover anyhow. Yet two other judicial districts are presiding over by Jew judges, and still the full list of Jew magistrates is not complete. But to enumerate farther would become wearisome. Two of the members of the Subway Commission, Jews, and of Jew school trustees, there is a goodly throng. Most of them are so-called baptized Jews that magically changed them and disguised themselves as Christians. Look out for them. Well, I look out for both Jews and Christians. On the police justice bench, there sat until comparatively recently a Jew who, if he had met with his deserts, would have been impeached and held up to ineffable infamy. His lechery, which he did not even lay aside when on the bench, was a subject of public scandal. Whenever a good-looking female complainant or prisoner appeared before him, he would invariably descend from the bench, lead her into the magistrate's private room, and hold an interview with her behind bolted doors. Whenever an abandoned woman was arraigned before him, he would impose a fine, which fine would be duly remitted after the interview behind locked doors in the judge's private room. The scandal grew to be so flagrant that the court officers and police reporters would wink at one another and watch with suggestive smirks as the Jew judge descended from the bench and disappeared into his private room behind a petticoat. There would be another grin as the bolt was sharply shut too. The smiles, broader than ever, would finally the judge a quarter of an hour later would, with flushed cheeks and dilated nostrils, emerge from his private retreat. More than once, the janitress of Essex Market Police Court caught this Jew agitator in positions more than uncompromising. All of these things were done openly, blatantly, with Jew brazenness and audacity in open court. Finally, the scandal smelled so to heaven that the commissioners of the charities and corrections who have charge of the furniture and fixtures of the police courts and the police justices' rooms removed the lounge from this particular magistrate's private apartment. Whenever he passed, according to the system of rotation, followed by the police justices to a new court, the operation of removing the lounge was resorted to. But this judicial libertine was no stickler at trifles, and the mere removal of his convenient article of furniture had little, if any, effect in checking the tete-a-tete in which he was wont to indulge. These facts can readily be verified. Any police court officer, any police court reporter of 3 years standing will be in a position to substantiate them. Entrenched in the coroner's office is a little Jew who cuts such a grotesque figure and who possesses so many qualities preeminently typical of his race that he deserves more than passing mention. This little Jew, in his eagerness to capture personal popularity and political votes, is all things and to all men. Not a German public banquet or gathering occurs upon which he does not inflict his presence. At the Liederkranz or the Ariane, he will sing German songs. And loading himself to bursting with good cheer at others' expense, he will obtrude his ill-shapen Jew paunch in Christian faces. At every Volksfest, he is present with a ready-made speech. Now, you can see the way he's talking that there were a tremendous amount of German Jews flocked into this country. When the French societies annually celebrate the fall of the Bastille, he will repair to the Lion Park wearing a tricolor in his hat, and with well-simulated Gaelic air, he will drink to the prosperity of La Patrie. At the annual Swiss festival, he is ever on hand, and when the Bavarians join together and make merry, the most boisterous Bavarian of them all is the Jew coroner. On St. Patrick's Day, he joins in the procession of the Sons of Hibernia, wearing a green tie and green gloves, an Irish Jew. Who ever heard of such a thing? Well, I know one thing. I've heard of the Abbey's Irish Rose, and that was when these Jews, a lot of them went up into Ireland and they snagged white Aryan women. I knew a guy who owned a Western Auto store in Fallbrook, California, this Jew, and he referred to his wife as Abbey's Irish Jew, which should have been an insult, but she just sort of snickered. Well, he had a heart attack and dropped dead on the floor, so I guess he got what he deserved. All this feasting and picnicking and parading, the Jew coroner takes good care, shall not cost him 1 cent. In fact, penuriousness is one of the most salient Jewish characteristics. To such an extent does he carry this penuriousness that he... That's a big-ass word. Penuriousness. That he actually carries off the stationery of the coroner's office to his home so as to be supplied with free writing material. His quit and extensive correspondence with his correspondents costs him nothing. But how about the postage? Bless you, he takes good care not to lay out any shekels for that either. After writing his numerous letters at his home on the free official stationery, he carefully carries the letters back to the coroner's office, where he can get postage stamped free of expense to him with the office stamps. What do you think of that? It is a typical Jew trick. And these are the few samples of the Jew politicians whom the easygoing and indifferent American people allow to be elected to their public offices, enabling Jew judges to lay down the law for Gentile litigants, permitting Jew officials to handle Christian monies, Aryan monies, electing Jew legislators to frame the Aryan laws, selecting Jew trustees to have the directing of Aryan schools. In view of the past history and growing prominence of the Jew in official life, it is not that the American people gave some serious thought and attention to the Jew in politics. The Jew in journalism, oh boy, physical degradation follows closely upon moral degradation. This is strongly remarked among the Jews, who of all races of men are the most depraved. That's a statement by Lavater. Just 41 years ago, on the outskirts of a little town in Austrian Hungary, where the tribes of Israel are gathering thick, was born of Jewish parents, a boy who was destined to play a prominent role in public life of this country. The boy grew to be tall, lanky, and raw-boned, with stooped shoulders, large, straggling feet, and the aggressive proboscis particular to his race. Proboscis means nose. Judging from the particular curvature of his nasal bone, he belonged to the tribe of Ephraim. His head was covered with thick tufts of untidy red hair, but inside this untidy covered head there worked a brain ablaze with activity, shrewdness, cunning, and ambition. Education in Europe is usually an expensive matter, but fortunately for the young Jew, there was an exceptionally good public school in the neighboring townland, which could be attended free of expense, and he availed himself of the opportunity thus afforded. With the great regularity and highly satisfactory results, he was a quick, alert scholar, but nevertheless was not popular among his schoolmates. They conferred a number of unpleasant nicknames upon him, one of which said to have been Antichrist. I would say Anti-Aryan. Of the young Jew's school days, an antidote is related which may perhaps be regarded by some as strikingly typical of events in his after career. The story runs that upon one occasion he and a number of companions were playing marbles. There was an unusual find displayed of alleys and commonies and other varieties of the little spheres upon the ground, and the Jew lust of possession, that lust of possession congenital to his race, was aroused. Presently, turning upon one of his companions, he said in a loud voice and with great emphasis of gesture, accused him of cheating. The lad, taken by surprise, stammered out a denial of the charge, but the Jew overwhelmed him with abuse and with much volubility. With his earliest years, he had a fine flow of words, denounced his crime, proposed that immediate punishment be meted out. The other boys, carried away by the young Jew's fervor, promptly acquiesced, and the alleged culprit was dragged off to the neighboring tree, securely tied and soundly whipped with a knotted pocket handkerchiefs and pieces of cord. The punishment over, the boys returned to their marbles, only to find that every one of them had disappeared. So had the Jew. While the punishment which he had invoked was being administered, he had walked off with the coveted spoils. As the young Jew reached his 19th year, he found himself in danger of being compelled to enter the army of his native land and go through the usual term of military service. There was no tangible gain in that, and he accordingly decided to immigrate to this country. He arrived in the U.S. in 1865, the closing year of the war. It is doubtful whether the young Jew immigrant felt any very profound enthusiasm or interest in the questions or principles at issue in our great internecine struggle. But heavy bounties were being paid at the time, and perhaps this fact was not unremotely connected to his enlisting in the 1st New York Cavalry Regiment within a few days after he landed. Thus his first sphere of action upon landing on these shores was, after evading military service in the land of his birth, to hire out here as a mercenary, to engage in human slaughter in return for a fat bounty and so many dollars a month. It was not the cause of freedom that made this young Jew eager to enter the military service of his country. It was not the flag of the Union that warmed his blood. It was the money he was after. He coveted the dollar. Country, in the sense we attach to this word, has no meaning whatever to the Jew. The Jew will fight as readily in Germany for thalers as he will fight in Russia for rubles. The Jew is a member of the inexorable universality. It has been charged that this particular Jew, however, did very little in the way of slaughtering rebels, and it is asserted that he returned no substantial equivalent for the fat bounty upon which his itching palm had so eagerly closed. That, in plain words, he became a professional bounty jumper. But this charge has never been fully substantiated, and he should at least be entitled to the Scotch verdict of not proven. After the close of the war, he drifted west, where he finds himself settled for the winter, grooming horses. During the following summer, he worked on a farm, and next became a stoker in an old Mississippi steamer, and later still was employed in the same capacity on the Belleville ferry boat. The wages, however, were small, and when the cholera broke out, and the, to him, comparatively large sum of $2 per grave was offered for men to dig the last resting places for those who had died of cholera, The Jew sprang eagerly into the work. The mortality was immense. You notice how all this, these disease epidemics break out after a war? They don't talk about that much. The other problems of war. First World War, we got the Black Death, which wiped out a large percentage of white Europe. After the Civil War, we had this cholera epidemic that wiped out hundreds and thousands. These things always follow war. The mortality was immense. The completion in the dangerous business of grave digging for cholera victims extremely slack. And following the traditions of his race, the Jew reaped, or more accurately speaking, shoveled in large returns from the general desolation. It is not difficult to draw a mental picture of this man bending with his hawk-like face over the graves heaped up with putrescence, working with feverish energy, thinking of nothing, caring for nothing, save the money which his soul thirsted with an unspeakable intensity, and with wild ambitions and strange lusts of power and possession whirling through the brain, pulsating under the tufty reddish hair. The cholera epidemic over, the Jew worked for a short time as a waiter in a St. Louis restaurant, and next donned the livery of a coachman in a stable standing at this day within pistol shot of the Southern Hotel in St. Louis. The ambition to rise and to possess was as strong as ever within him. He had a good deal of spare time in his new position, and his spare time he assiduously employed in perfecting himself in the English language and acquiring a general knowledge. Within a very short time, he launched out as an attorney, which vocation he followed only for a few weeks, and then became a reporter on a German newspaper, I guess. It seems something must be missing. He rapidly made the acquaintance of a number of practical politicians, anglicizing his first name and his surname to the form in which they are so well known today, and succeeded, although still an alien, in getting himself elected to the legislature from a district in which he had never paid a tax, in which he had never been even lived. The fraud was, however, discovered, and he was promptly disqualified. Not in the least abashed, much less discouraged, he resumed his reporterial and political wire-pulling. He began to make a specialty of unearthing jobs and of exposing all manner of frauds and impositions. He was a great expert in such things, seeming to literally scent out the places where corruption existed. He became an object of fear and dread in certain political quarters, and finally it was deemed a wise and political measure by certain political personages to effect a deal whereas the Jew was appointed police commissioner of Democratic St. Louis, although he was at the time a pronounced and aggressive Republican. And now began a regime that will be long remembered in St. Louis. At last, at this hungry Jew from the poverty-stricken provinces of Hungary had the opportunity for which his soul so long had hungered. The gambler, the publican, the keeper of the bawdy house, the prostitute, the policy shop man, the receiver of stolen goods, all were squeezed with a merciless pressure hitherto unknown. From 101 quarters, gold flowed in an unbroken stream into the lean, outstretched fingers of the Magyar ex-gravedigger. No form of vice was too small, too petty, too exempt from attention. Sources that no Gentile political office holder, no matter how astute, had ever dreamed of stirring up, were now ferreted out and subjected to official pressure. You know, I think the Jews had a great success in drug distribution in this country. And they all have made a fortune allegedly suppressing, you know, like marijuana and so forth. So they benefit from both sides always. And, of course, all the judges that put people away for having marijuana and so forth. Had the rule of the Jew police commissioner lasted much longer, crime and fast life in St. Louis would have died from sheer inanition. It was the old story over again of the marbles of his school days. Ye cannot serve God and mammon, says Holy Writ. It does not apply to the Jews. We have known many Jews who could serve both at the same time. In fact, most. After stepping down from the police commission in Richmond, the Jew bought out a St. Louis newspaper and continued his exposure of the evil deeds of others. The publication flourished and the bank account of its proprietor fattened. 5 years ago, he came east and bought the organ which he presents and operates with so much noise and so much profit. From the day that he took possession of this organ, fortune seemed to favor him. A great daily became involved in a stupendous fight with the news dealers. Another daily bolted the Democratic presidential nominee. Thousands of Democrats refused to buy their organ, and the news dealers substituted the Jews' organ upon every occasion. Into the opening thus made, the Jew crept, and thence rose upward to the high tide of success. You know, boys, like the New York Times, Boston Globe, all of those papers are Jew family papers and owned by corporations. And now the Jews' advent began to exercise its blighting influence on American journalism. Hitherto, no daily newspaper in New York save one, which charged a practically prohibitory rate of $2.50 per line, had sold its news columns for disguised advertising puffs. Even the small items of reading matter inserted by advertisers were marked with the warning ADV for the protection of the public, lest they be, by chance, be mistaken for unsophisticated reader for the statements of the paper itself. To sell the editorial or news columns of a leading morning daily had hitherto been regarded in the great, proud world of New York newspaperdom as journalistic harlotry. For a metropolitan daily to offer its editorial and news spaces for the consideration was looked upon professionally as like a woman offering her body for a price. It was the scarlet sin of journalism, a great newspaper's prostitution, its shame. But under the regime of the Jew journalist, all this journalistic scrupulosity, not to say sense of honor, vanished. Any scheme could be puffed, any enterprise boomed without hesitation, without regard to its merits or even honesty. At a cost of $1 per line, hordes of Jew canvassers, underpaid, dirty of beard and long of coat, swarmed through the business thoroughfares soliciting, like touters for a bawdy house, merchants, speculators, bankers, brokers, mining sharks, and real estate jobbers, to boom their enterprises in the Jew organ at $1 a line, reduced rates being daily offered for large orders of several columns or more. Whole papers filled with alluring illustrations were given up to lauding rascality, land colonization schemes, and poor people who believed that what they read was given on the responsibility of a great metropolitan daily were lured into parting with their money for lands that were in many cases practically as valueless as a stretch of sand in the wastes of the Sahara. A corps of special writers was kept employed in the office to weld these paid puffs into such shapes as they would disguise their real nature and cause them to read as genuine news reports. Well, let's finish out this chapter here. Blow, bluster, and brag, bluster, and blow were made to take up a goodly portion of the space formerly allotted to legitimate news, succeeding, unfortunately, only too well with an easily gulled public and a rancorous vituperation and vile abuse replaced the dignified editorial. It will thus be perceived that the metropolitan journalism sickened and deteriorated with the injection of Semitic blood into its veins. With the acquisition of a great wealth and power, the Jews' characteristic love of display asserted itself. Upon the occasion of a visit to Europe some time ago, this Jew contrived to have the title of Baron for a consideration, of course conferred upon himself, an extraordinary title indeed for the proprietor of a democratic organ to seek. He is now making strenuous efforts to figure in American society. He is engaged in one of the principal editors of his organ, a pompous, puffed-up popinjay who possesses little other qualification save that of having weighty social conditions. The most important duty of this person is to secure for his Jew patron an entree into the exclusive social circles. So far, he has met with no success. But boy, I'll tell you, now they've succeeded. They're in everything. Furthermore, he is not likely to meet with any. Lifted to this high pinnacle of material prosperity, it will be interesting to watch what the future career of this brilliantly able, merciless, crafty, and restless, ambitious scion of the Semitic race will be. And that is the end of that chapter on the media. The next chapter, they're going to keep going on this great American journalist. Now, it's interesting that there's cartoon pictures all through this book, and they look exactly like A. Wyatt Man's cartoons of the Jew. It's unbelievable. He may have got his ideas from this book. I don't know. Anyhow, that's page 77, and let's see here. We've got 217 pages in the book, so we've got a ways to go. But we will, I think, tomorrow go back to our Terror in the Night, the KKK war against the Jews. Yeah. Meanwhile, I got a couple of letters here I was going to read to you. And this one's from an associate, and he's out in New York State. I like your reading of the Terror in the Night. I heard you want feedback on your readings. I personally like your readings. You should continue because we have to know where the enemy is the most vulnerable and who all our enemies are. And we need to understand strategies and tactics. We need to understand supplies and logistics. We need to understand everything. So keep up the readings and the updated news. Yours truly. Well, thank you, sir. Lone Wolf from New York. Now, this is a sort of funny one from a guy who writes me once in a while. He's in prison out in California, and due to some chicanery, they got him in the hole. So he's wanted me to send him a book or two, which I have. And this is a letter that's sort of funny, but it shows you a little bit of insight into prison life. Greetings once again. I say hello. I'm still in the hole. Thank God my fake-ass skinhead Selly moved out. He lives with another fake named Birchfield. So you know, if Joe Birchfield writes, he lies about everything. Those two idiots talk some of the most high-power, white power I have ever heard in my life. Birchfield claims he was in Mexico and saw a screwdriver play in a non-white country, and he and Stewart kicked him in the face. I've never seen a white power rock and roll band play in Mexico, let alone kick a white supremacist in the face. He said the screwdriver was banned in the U.S. Funny shit, huh? My old Sally tries too hard to be a skinhead, and he claims he's worked white power shows, and the bands had made him, had him beating people up. All the shows we all went to fighting would get the band to stop playing. These two yahoos claim that they have attacked the guys for talking shit about Hitler. They believe in Hitlerization. Hitler would have killed both of them, these fakes. Remember Rick Fought and Joseph Birchfield. They deserve nothing. They bring heat upon themselves. And here our fight is on the streets, not in prison. Anyhow, Tom, I need some books, hopefully some good old Klan stuff, something from, what? Mr. David Duke. I think I will send him a couple of Duke's books, and I want to get them out of my library. And I'll take anything to read you can help an old friend out with. I hope to beat all this, and I wasn't involved in anything. Tom, I'm lucky my old Sally tells me he's going to go to classification and yell white power. So stupid. He thinks I'm impressed. I'm not at all. Here's one more story he told me. He was in San Francisco and was driving and said he saw 100 or so faggots. So he claims he turned around in his 1974 four-wheeler truck and ran over about 40 of them and killed them and got away. Is that some strange way out shit? Well, Tom, send me some good books. I can't get stamps back to you now. Here, I've received no mail since I've been here. Well, I just sent him a book about a week ago, so he should have it. I think our correspondence crossed in the mail. And it's a good idea. You want David Duke books? I got a couple of those Duke books. I don't even think I ever read them. I'll send them to him. Yeah, okay. But this is an example of what goes on at prison. And I hear it all the time. Guys bragging about all kinds of crazy crap that never took place, couldn't have taken place, and if it had taken place, they'd be doing 100 years in the electric chair. But there's some good, steady-minded guys in there, too, and that's who we have to worry about and try to help them out. But the majority of people in there deserve to be in there, and they even deserve a lot more from the shit they spread around among other inmates and try to get other inmates in trouble. So that's that one. Now I'm going to close out with a sad, sad story about next summer's Olympics down south in South America. And it's something that they're touching on here, but not very much. But it's a hell of a lot worse than what you've heard. If you know anybody that's going to compete in the Olympics, tell them don't go. And if you're planning a vacation to watch the Olympics in this country, don't go, and here's why. But first, let's hear from Jonathan Pollard, that poor Jewish boy that's been in prison for stealing so-called secrets. How about that?
The hour. Well, what have we covered tonight? It's all been so damn negative so far. How would you like a little mystery and intrigue? Huh? You want something that I don't know. I just find it kind of actually I find it more than a little bizarre. The U.S. Navy, according to Raw Story, is investigating a complaint that seeks the evacuation of civilian and military lawyers from parts of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the base there, following reports of cancer cases among personnel working on the trials of detainees that are still being held. At least seven civilians and military members who worked on detainee trials at Guantanamo have been diagnosed with cancer, according to a complaint which was filed with the U.S. Defense Department's Office of the Inspector General. The complaint calls on American military officials to remove personnel from court facilities at the base at Guantanamo and test them and the base itself for carcinogens. Now, this is really weird because the complaint claims that an unusually large number of relatively healthy and relatively young people who worked at the base have been diagnosed with cancer. The complaint says that these people may have been exposed to carcinogens when they lived and worked in the location at Guantanamo that was formerly used to dispose of jet fuel. Oh, I see. I see. Anybody remember Jonathan Pollard? The Israeli spy that released the most information ever released and has been imprisoned since, oh my God, since when? 1987. He was an Israeli spy. He worked for the U.S. Navy. And here's the story. This is from Vox.com to explain, if you're not familiar here. In May 1984, Pollard was a young analyst for the U.S. Navy's now-defunct Anti-Terrorist Alert Center. Pollard approached an Israeli Air Force colonel, Aviram Sela, and offered to provide U.S. intelligence documents on Israel's enemies. After consulting with Israeli higher-ups, Sela agreed. Though Pollard hadn't asked for money up front, he was paid $1,500 per month starting in November 1984 and also received thousands of dollars worth of jewelry for his wife. It is not clear why Pollard approached Sela with his plan. He has said he was concerned for Israeli security, but Pollard had a long prior history of erratic behavior. Oh, really? And has been accused of passing secrets to other countries as well, including South Africa and Pakistan. In November 1985, Pollard apparently learned that his arrest was imminent and attempted to flee with his wife to the Israeli embassy to request asylum. The embassy refused them entry, and the FBI arrested them outside the gates. Israel and U.S. always works together on stuff like this, you know. Pollard had, over a year and a half, leaked about 2,300 documents on topics ranging from Soviet air defenses to Egyptian missile systems. He pled guilty to espionage in 1987 and is now serving a life sentence at the Butner Federal Correction in Complex in Butner, North Carolina. I might add, although it's not in the article, that Butner also is a institution is there for the criminally insane who have been convicted of serious crimes, but were found either guilty but insane or not guilty by reason of insanity or whatever the legal term is. But Butner, North Carolina is known for that. Anyway, there was a report Friday from the Wall Street Journal, and U.S. Justice Department officials denied that the possible release of Pollard, who is up for parole in November, has anything to do with the Iran deal. What? Oh, Wall Street Journal. Yeah, well, that figures. Another Murdoch garbage publication. According to the Department of Justice, there has been no special consideration for Pollard in light of the nuclear deal. And the DOJ stated their position that Pollard should serve every day of his sentence. On Saturday, 2 days ago, Ynet News reported that Israeli officials have confirmed that Pollard is set to be released from U.S. prison this year, but emphasized to the Israeli newspaper, Ynet, that this was unrelated to the recent deal signed between six world powers and Iran. Well, anyway. Meanwhile, journalists like the Toronto Star columnist Heather Malik said The Intercept's Glenn Greenwald raised important points about the difference between an actual spy like Pollard, who has nearly completed his 30-year sentence, and a new generation of whistleblowers in the U.S., among them Chelsea Manning and Ed Snowden, who both face the prospect of decades in jail for leaking government secrets to journalists in the name of democratic accountability. and the public good. U.S. government don't like its secrets getting out. Pollard was an actual spy. Pollard jeopardized U.S. national security. Pollard was in the same mindset as the Israeli military that attacked the USS Liberty and killed 37 U.S. sailors and injured, wounded 150 more, with repeated attacks by the Israeli Air Force to try to destroy the USS Liberty, for which nobody has ever been found culpable or responsible, not really where they had to serve a term or were hanged. I mean, that's a war crime. You hang war crime. Oh, I guess you don't. Yeah, but that happened in 1967. Back in 1967, war criminals were... Well, no, wait a second. No, we were heavily involved in Vietnam by then. Well, I guess war criminals, if they're American or Israeli, nothing happens to them. Ever. Ever. Now, spies, that's a different game. If a spy is caught, why? Well, you know, we'll punish that son of a bitch just boom, that quick. But war criminals, no. You know, you can make the argument, and I don't know if this argument has been made or if it's even a valid argument. But how many people died because of the information that Pollard released to the Israeli government? I don't know. Maybe thousands. I have no idea. How many people died as a result of the Bush crime family's actions in the Middle East? Ooh, wait a minute. Yeah. Okay. To an investigation, it's like a lake is basically raw sewage. An Associated Press analysis of water quality found dangerously high levels of viruses and bacteria from human sewage in these water venues. The Rodrigo de Freitas Lake, which was supposedly cleaned up in recent years, was thought to be safe for rowers and canoers, yet the test by the Associated Press found its waters to be among the most polluted for Olympic sites. And most of it is being caused by human poop. And this includes Copacabana Beach, right, where hundreds of swimmers and boaters are scheduled to compete in next year's Olympics. The report was published last Thursday by two reporters, Jenny Barchfield and Brad Brooks. And the investigators, these two, found, quote, dangerously high levels of viruses and bacteria from untreated sewage in the country's Olympic venues. Now, this is a fairly common thing. Apparently, in Brazil, they don't have sewage treatment plants. They just dump it into the nearest gutter, and it eventually works its way to the ocean, to the beaches. The high levels of contamination, according to this report, are really putting these Olympic athletes at risk, some of whom, who are there training, some have already experienced fevers, vomiting, and diarrhea. One expert told the Associated Press that if athletes ingest even 3 tablespoons of this water, they have a 99% risk of infection. The guy is John Griffith, a marine biologist who examined and evaluated the AP's investigation. He said, quote, what you have here is basically raw sewage. It's all the water from the toilets and the showers and whatever people put down their sinks all mixed up. It's all going out into the beach waters. Now, Brazilian officials, I mean, what are they going to say? They've assured the Associated Press and the Olympic Committee that the water will be safe in time for the games next summer, which, by the way, is something they've been saying for a while. This is not the first time the public has been warned about the foulness of Brazil's Olympic venues. The AP describes it like this, quote, extreme water pollution is common in Brazil, where the majority of sewage is not treated. Raw waste runs through open-air ditches to streams and rivers that feed the Olympic water sites. As a result, Olympic athletes are almost certain to come into contact with disease-causing viruses that in some tests measured up to 1.7 million times the level of what would be considered hazardous on a Southern California beach. 1.7 million times as poisonous. Oh, Christ. The stench of raw sewage still greets travelers touching down at Rio's International Airport. Prime beaches are deserted because the surf is thick with putrid sludge, and periodic fish die-offs leave the Olympic Lake littered with rotting fish. Nearly 1,400 athletes are expected to be exposed to these waters next year, according to Associated Press. Now, water is a huge problem in Brazil, not only because of this kind of contamination, but according to the Washington Post, because of an intense, long-standing drought. Oh, there's the D word again, huh? I think progress, not Washington Post. Think progress. The D word again. The drought not only adds stress to the country's water supply during a major sporting event, but presumably it means there's very little that officials can do because they can't. There's no water to dilute this mess and try to bring, you know, the toxicity down. There's nothing they can do. Now, according to Think Progress, this is not the first time environmental conditions have threatened major sporting events. Just last month in Santiago, Chile, the Copa America soccer tournament coincided with dangerous smog levels in the city, and extreme heat exacerbated by climate change caused suspension of outdoor play at the Australian Open last summer. And when Brazil hosted the World Cup last year, experts warned that the effects of climate change could threaten players' health in the future. Oh, and by the way, air travel in Brazil during the World Cup was expected to produce the equivalent of 2.72 million metric tons of greenhouse gases, which is the same as approximately 500,000 cars driving for a year. Large sporting events themselves have negative impacts on the environment. So just the air travel to Brazil during the World Cup, the same amount of greenhouse gases as 560,000 cars driving for a year. Oh, and by the way, one of the stadiums constructed for the World Cup was built in the middle of the Amazon rainforest. You know, you almost get the sense, don't you, sometimes, that the human species deserves to die off because we're so...
Well, there you go. Pleasant dreams, lone wolves. If worse is better, it's working, I'm telling you. And we let these Brazilians come in and immigrate to the United States. I remember I worked for Douglas Aircraft back in the early 60s, and we had a guy come into my lab that was from Brazil, and he got a job, and he stunk like hell. And I said, you know, you stink like hell. Back then, we weren't afraid of offending people. Do you ever use any deodorant? He said, oh, no, we don't use deodorant. I don't think they use soap and water either. So these are the kind of people that are coming in here by the busloads into the United States. And people, they just think they're going to be like Joe Blow down the street, clean, white, okay. Well, anyhow, see you tomorrow, 14-5.